what we're going to do today is we're going to do a DNA symbol workshop. The first time I heard this did was, I don't know, several years ago at a I believe it was Gretna, and the room was full, overrunning, and what I heard was real powerful. And I've heard it on tape several times, and I get a good message out of it every time. The fellow that's going to do it for us is from Cone Grove from Tennessee, and his name is Greg Peace. Come on up, Greg.
My name's Greg. I'm an addict. Hello, hello, hello. I haven't done this in a long time. I did a couple of workshops on the symbol, probably about almost 10 years ago now. And it's a strange topic for a workshop because most of us skip over that page when we look at the stuff, or if we try to read it, we get real confused because it's written fairly in a manner that is confusing to a lot of us. I know it was confusing to me when I first saw that material. If you don't know what we're talking about by the symbol, this is what we're talking about right here. This symbol right here, of course, with the word self, society, service, and God on them. That's the DNA symbol. It's been called our service symbol. There are two registered marks that we have. We have that mark, and we have the logo that has the DNA in it. And this symbol was designed, I guess, talk a little bit about where it comes from, first of all, was designed in the late 60s. One of the people that helped start NA as we know it came down with tuberculosis. And he was hospitalized for a period of several years as a result of the TB. At the time, he had, I guess he'd probably been clean 18 years, something like that. He is the one that designed this symbol, and the first time it was produced as part of his physical therapy on leather. It's one of the things that they taught him in the hospital was tooling leather. He had been a roofer, and he would never be able to work in that trade, at least not to any degree, because of his physical health. And part of the hospitalization process was some retraining. And our symbol comes right out of that. It isn't anything more complicated or bizarre than that. I suspect, although I do not know, that since not long before that, there had been a lot of discussion in Alcoholics Anonymous about the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, and their three-sided symbol was developed, each side representing one of the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. Recovery, and someone may have to help me with this, recovery, unity, and service, I think, are the three sides, are what's written on the three sides of their triangle in a circle. That ours grew out of that idea, and that a fourth side was added, and ours had become self-society, service, and God. I personally believe, and I believe for a long time, that there aren't a whole lot of accidents when things like that happen, that there are reasons for stuff like that. And perhaps, one of the opportunities we as a fellowship have is to explore a fourth legacy of this 12-step movement that we're all part of, I guess is what we can talk about, how we can talk about it. That maybe part of what NA is about is that. The symbol itself really kind of laid in dormancy for a long time after that. The next time the design was used that I know of was in the mid-70s, where it was modified
to be part of an approved literature stamp. When we first started having approved literature, and we'd stamp the little IPs, the pamphlets, because all there was the white booklet. We'd stamp a stamp, and it had that with an NA in it, and it said approved literature. And that meant that was fellowship, that was material that the fellowship had approved for publication. It was official NA literature. And that was the next time that symbol was used that I know of. And it was published, the description that you see was published in 1976 as the beginning of a booklet called The NA Tree, which was the first service structure document that we had. It was the thing that described the representative system which allowed each of us to participate in NA as a whole, to be represented, to have a voice in Narcotics Anonymous, to be part of the conscience of a worldwide fellowship. The service structure is what makes that possible. Let me read what it said there, and this, I believe, is almost identical to what exists today in the literature. I don't believe there were many changes to that in some of the changes that took place in the basic text along the years. It appeared in the basic text when it first came out. Our NA symbol. Simplicity is the keynote of our symbol. It follows the simplicity of our fellowship. We could find all sorts of occult and esoteric connotations in the simple outlines, but foremost in our minds were easily understood meanings and relationships. The outer circle denotes a universal program, and a universal and total program that has room within it for all manifestations of the recovering and wholly recovered person. The square, whose lines are defined, is easily seen and understood, but there are other unseen parts of the symbol. The square base denotes goodwill, the ground of both the fellowship and the member of our society. Actually, it is the four pyramid sides that rise from the base in a three-dimensional figure that are self, society, service, and God. All rise to a point of freedom. All parts thus far are closely related to the needs and aims of the addict seeking recovery, and the purpose of the fellowship seeking to make recovery available to all. The greater the bases we grow in unity, in numbers, and in fellowship, the broader the sides, and the higher the point of freedom. Probably the last to be lost to freedom will be the stigma of being an addict. Goodwill is best exemplified in service, and proper service is doing the right thing for the right reason. When this supports and motivates both the individual and the fellowship, we are fully whole and wholly free. And that was the big first description of this symbol. And I had to translate that a little bit in order for it to make sense to me. And to me, this whole thing represents the fellowship. That's us. As we grow in the fellowship, our circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger. When I came to Narcotics Anonymous in 1970, there were perhaps 200 NA members, people actively going to NA, and maybe 20 groups. When Beto first appeared on the scene 5-6 years before that, there were maybe 100. People actively involved in NA, and people would come and go. And there was not a whole lot of fellowship. I mean, we're talking about a fellowship the size of people in this room. And what is there, 100 chairs set up here, roughly? Maybe more than 100 chairs set up here. There were not many more NA members when I came around that could sit in this room right now. And there are meetings like this that happen on a weekly basis in countries, in cities all over the world. There are this many people getting together on any given night of the week. How many times? Every day. You know, that's part of the idea that's expressed there about this growing. The description talks about the relationships and it talks about this coming up to a point of freedom. As the base grows, if you've got a little tiny base down here, the point of it's right there.
You got a base here that points up here. You got a base out here that points up here. As we grow in numbers, that's what that phrase means. The sides of the pyramid get bigger, and the point of freedom, which is the top of the pyramid, gets higher and higher and higher. So as we grow and as we share and as we participate in this thing called Narcotics Anonymous, we contribute to each other's recovery. We grow as individuals. We grow as a fellowship. As that happens, the result is freedom. And it's from that idea we take in our promise, you know, where it says in our basic text that our promise is freedom. First of all, freedom from self, and then freedom from that part of us that we destroy. That idea grows, is parallel to what we're talking about here with freedom as we grow. Personally and as a fellowship, our freedom increases. The sides get stronger, self, society, service of God. And those are four key relationships. I'm trying to think of when it was. I believe in 1986, I might be able to tell you. No, I can't. Somewhere in the late 80s, 1986, I believe, but I'm not sure, about 10 years ago. Might have been 1987. I was at that time involved in World Services on the Board of Trustees. I was waiting to come to a World Service Conference, so it was a little later than this in the year. And I woke up the morning that I was supposed to fly to California with a thought about the relationship of our symbol to our steps and traditions. There had been talk around the fellowship recently at that point about developing some principles of service, which has grown into what you guys know as the concepts of service. And that fleshed out a third part. Actually, what had happened was somebody had taken AA's 12 concepts of world service and did a word substitution and passed out copies. And of course that was heralded by many and objected to by many others. Just like everything that happens in our fellowship is heralded by many and objected to by many others, it seems like. So the issue of a possible set of something like the steps and traditions, but revolving around service, was an issue of the time. And I had an awareness about how perhaps the four sides, those four relationships that are described, might relate to those things. You know, the steps are about us. It says in our readings on the traditions, the steps are for the individual. So self relates to the 12 steps. It says in our literature that when it's talking about the traditions, we read it today, they're talking about our society or our relationship with society at large. So society has to do with our traditions. Service, the issue at hand was service. I personally think that, and this is a very personal opinion, that the 12 concepts that we approved at our World Service Conference a few years ago, although they contained some very good advice and suggestions for how to do service and how to do business in Narcotics Anonymous, that they missed the point as far as capturing the basic spiritual ideas we have about service. There's some things that in Narcotics Anonymous that I think are unique to us concerning service that to me are our true principles of service that aren't really covered in the 12 concepts. And that perhaps there's a fourth area that we need to look at as a fellowship, and that comes under the heading of God. And it's our unique approach to spirituality. Our very special way of relating with reality and each other and and God. That, of course, has been mirrored and is drawn from many different places, but we have a real experience that maybe we have responsibility someday to share. I hope we as a fellowship can take up that challenge. That perhaps there is a fourth area that needs to be explored and developed. As I went through and became more and more aware of the steps, the self part of the symbol, my understanding has grown and changed, and just like all of us, happened. I don't know about you, but when I first came around, I was convinced that I was messed up because of the drugs, and my life was messed up because of all the weird stuff I did and being strung out. And if I could just kick and clean up, then everything would be okay. Well, also like most of us, shortly thereafter, I learned that that wasn't true because I kicked and cleaned up and everything wasn't okay. And I learned a little bit more about that thing we call being powerless over addiction in our life having become unmanageable. I learned that that was all-encompassing. I can remember going, oh, my God, it's not the drugs. I can remember sitting thinking, well, I knew I was messed up, but I had no idea. I can remember getting depressed as I ever remember being behind realizing that even though I wasn't using, my disease was alive and well and kicking my butt on a regular basis. That I was trapped in my addiction, even without drugs. And I think we all come to that awareness eventually. And it can be devastating. That can be a devastating awareness. Some of us go, well, what's the use? And they're gone. Unless they have the loving support that only we can give each other. When a person comes to that crisis in their recovery, that threshold in the recovery, I believe the most important, the two things that get them through that crisis. One is the habits of participation and attendance and meetings that they've built up. And number two, the loving support of other addicts. Tell them it's going to be okay. We went through the same thing. You're not going crazy. This is not the way it's going to be forever. You're supposed to feel this way. Now, if we can communicate that, then we won't lose as many to that crisis. And all of you have got friends you've lost because they struggled and were unable to make that leap of faith. I know I've had friends I've lost who were unable to make that leap of faith. And it hurts. I can remember at one point praying, God, never let me care about another addict. Because it hurts too bad when they go. And then I realized that not to care was even worse for me. It hurts worse not to care than to care, even knowing someone might not choose this way of life, might reject this way of life, and go out there and die the horrible death that most of us were close to when we got here. I experienced those things. We can help each other on that. I think that's a lot of what our task is to do. As we continue to go through the steps, we develop our relationship with a higher power. We look to our past. You know, we try to develop our sense of morality. Learn what the rules for living are. Learn what our own life is about, what our morals are about, and we try to live that way. We accept that we can't fix our things. That was another devastating thing in recovery for me, the realization that I couldn't fix myself even with NA. Because I tried hard to fix myself with NA. I mean, once I got over the point that just stopping using was going to do it, I tried very hard to fix myself with NA. I wrote. I went to meetings. I called 14,000 people, drove all of them. We all did that stuff. Was trying to fix myself with Narcotics Anonymous. I came to a point where I realized that ultimately part of being powerless over my addiction and having a life that was unmanageable meant that I could not fix myself even with NA. That whatever fixing was going to take place was going to take place at a level far beyond me. And that's why I needed the sixth and seventh step. Because I needed to ask for that divine intervention. And then live this way. Live the way the program teaches. That whole process to me is what goes up and is represented by the self part of our symbol. When it talks about the society part of our symbol, to me describes our traditions, where we relate to each other and to other human beings, whether that's on a personal level. Vito does a great explanation about how each of us can personally utilize the principles of the 12 traditions in daily living. Either on that personal level, in our relationship with each other as NA members, in our relationship with others in society, and with the relationship with people at large and the world at large. I think our traditions address a lot of those things. Address the sorts of things like being fully self-supporting, physically, emotionally, spiritually. Being self-supporting instead of being that leech that we were and that dependent person that we were. Standing up on our own two feet and becoming a person in our own right. It's about not engaging in societies and outside controversies. It's about not hooking in to all these things that would distract us from recovery. It's about a principle of autonomy where each of us individually and collectively can survive, can make it. Where a group has the ability to thrive and flourish, even if another group in a community next door is struggling, and how we can help each other. So there are lots of things that come out in those traditions. As I said earlier, I think that there is a set of unique approaches to service that we have that aren't described in 12 concepts. There were several versions of principles or concepts for service that were floating around the fellowship in the late 60s. And let me read you some off of one that did not end up. But these, to me, cut a little closer to some of the underlying basics of what we call service. First of all, service is a spiritual principle. That by giving, we get. Our program teaches us that you know, we get back what we give. The therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. You reap what you sow. One of the first things that I think our service philosophy is about giving. It's about being of service. About establishing and developing our relationship with a God of our understanding through helping others. Service. And maybe people talk about the 12th step being the service step, but maybe even more than that. Certainly the fifth step is a service step where we're sharing with each other. Certainly the 11th step, knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out, is a service step. Service appears in many of the steps as a spiritual principle. It's one of those basic spiritual principles that our fellowship is built on. And I don't personally relate them one-to-one directly to the steps and traditions. I think they're mingled throughout, and that there's a whole series of principles. But the second one that I think that is speaks to NA service more so than other is that service should be inclusive rather than exclusive. That part of what NA is about is about involving people in service, whether that's cleaning up after a meeting, or whether that's sponsorship, whether that's participating on a committee, whether that's getting involved at some level. That is something of value to us as a principle in Narcotics Anonymous, that part of being an NA member is participation in service at some form. And each member has not only a need to do that, but a right to participate and to give of themselves. And we should present our services in a way that make them available to people to participate in, rather than to exclude people from participation in those services. It's kind of like in our traditions when they say the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. We've kind of carried that into our services, that the only requirement to serve, at least on the group level, is to show up and be willing. And we'll put you to work, whether it's cleaning up ashtrays or setting up chairs or making coffee or greeting people at the door or whatever, being involved in a function. If you show up and can express a willingness and commitment to the service, then you can be part of. And it depends on you, not on some arbitrary external saying, yes, you can or no, you can't serve. The third basic truth about our services is that ultimately we as members are the service providers. We're the ones who start the service in motion, and we're the ones who fulfill it ultimately. We have service boards and committees and all those things, but all those things ultimately are to help us meet our needs as members trying to recover together and to guide our actions as members trying to be mutually supportive. That ultimately it's us as members that do the service work. And without us doing the service work doesn't get done. Each of us is here because somebody was of service somewhere along the line. I heard of Narcotics Anonymous by calling someone else's helpline. And I'm not even sure. When I tell my story, I talk about I think it being a suicide line, and I think it was a suicide line. But I'm not really 100% sure. It was one of those things you hear at 3 o'clock in the morning on the radio, you know, when you're depressed anyway, and they said you got a problem, the drugs, call such and such a number. And I called, and they said, are you eligible for Narcotics Anonymous? And somebody made them aware somehow that Narcotics Anonymous existed. Either somebody contacted them directly, or somebody put the information out where they heard that Narcotics Anonymous existed and could refer me there. Here, that service. Somebody's service is the reason that I am here. And I honestly believe that someone's service is the reason that each and every one of us are here. You would not be here if it was not for someone's service. You could not be here because you never would have found us. Because we would never have been meeting here. Because the group in your community, the group you first fell into and fell in love with, would not exist. Would not be holding meetings if it wasn't for someone's service. And that's how important it is, and yet we'll talk that about service. Most of us, at one time or another, have talked about those lots for doing all that damn service work, and they're so selfish and self-centered, and it's really more their disease than their recovery, right? Anybody here not ever talked like that? I think everybody has. But if it wasn't for someone's service, none of us would be here. And us lots need to keep being of service, whether it's driven by disease or by recovery, because it's driven by both. I don't believe that a person can separate service out and say, well, I just won't do that. I don't believe a person can fulfill the 12 steps process without being of service. That service is tied directly into the process. Does not necessarily mean you have to be chairman of the World Service Conference or anything like that. But it means you have to give of yourself. It means you have to show up and stand up for what you believe in. And be willing to take some effort to support that. A fourth basic premise that is true about our services is our service is first and foremost for the addict who still suffers. I think we sometimes lose sight of that. Sometimes, probably the most common time we lose sight of that is we get caught up in the fundraising business. And the purpose of our service becomes to raise money, to support, indirectly, I guess, other services. But oftentimes, to support non-functional committees, committees that are meeting for the sake of meeting rather than for the sake of providing service, perhaps, in some cases. We lose sight of the fact that all our service should be directed for the addict who still suffers. We fall into a trap of you know, my convention's bigger and better than your convention, and lost sight of the fact that we need to provide a celebration of recovery for the most possible people. Somehow it seems that a lot of our events almost exclude the newcomer. And that's a tragedy. That's by making them too expensive for a newcomer to afford to go to, for one thing. By making the newcomer feel like a second-class citizen is another thing. We almost exclude people from some of our service efforts in the name of, well, you know, they're going to take more pamphlets than they buy. How many times have we not brought literature into an institution because the people in the institution weren't going to support their own literature and somebody else would have to pay for it? I think when we make those decisions, we miss the point of going into the institution. Sometimes those decisions are made on the reality that we can no longer afford to do this, but you know, there's something I think any of us can do. I can remember times when there wasn't any literature available, sitting down and copying what is the Narcotics Anonymous program longhand onto a Ditto Master and cranking to make a few copies to take into an institution on an old purple Ditto. You know, because we couldn't afford to buy life booklets at 25 cents a piece they were then. To take into the institutions, because there were just one or two of us driving the 200 miles once a week to go into this institution, and we were hurt. We lose sight of the carrying the message part of that, about the services for the addict. It's not for the committee. A fifth one, our service structure is a tool. That this thing we call the service structure is nothing more than a tool for helping us achieve our ends. We give it personality and power. Does a hammer have a personality? Does it, in and of itself, have a power? Sit there on the table. It's not going to do anything as long as it's sitting there on the table. The analogy I like to use for our service structure is like a coffee pot. Coffee pot is designed to provide a service. If you put the correct ingredients there, it is supposed to produce coffee. That's what it's for. If you don't put the ingredients in, it's not going to produce coffee. If you don't plug it in and give it support, energy, it's not going to produce coffee. if you produce the coffee and there isn't anybody there who wants any, then it's wasted energy. I think the analogy of our service structure to the coffee pot is great. We get out of it what we put into it. That we need to supply the support, electricity, supplies. We need to take the action to get it going. We need to turn it on. And once we do all those things, we can expect it to produce that which it was designed to produce. A lot of times we create things without any design of what they're supposed to do. Or we ignore the design. We have a, what's a safe one? I think in our temporary working guide, one of the things it says about our world level committees is they are not designed to do the actual work. I think the quote out of that the example is policy committees do not write policy. But how many times have we created a policy committee to write policy? When the agreed upon design is they're not supposed to do that. How many times do we look to literature committees to write literature? How many times do we look to finance committees to take care of our money problems? How many times do we look to activity committees to make successful activities? The reality is if no one shows up, it's not going to be successful, regardless of how well it's put together. We look to our committees to do all these things. And yet, because of what I talked about a little earlier, that really the services are of and by and for us. It's us that need to do these things, and the committees are just there to help us do those things. Another one, the principle of practical spirituality is at the heart of our service, the idea that if it's not practical, it's not spiritual. And that if something is spiritual, there will always be a way to achieve it. The idea behind that is that if something is in tune with spiritual principles, which is the right thing for the right reason at the right time in the right place, then there can be no insurmountable obstacle to it. When we run into roadblocks, I don't know about you, but in my personal life, when I keep running into brick walls, I have to consider the possibility that perhaps I'm going the wrong direction. And usually, I'll go, nah, and go smash through the brick wall a few more times before I surrender. I think that's part of being an addict. My consistent reaction to the need for surrender is, yeah, but, wait a second, let me try one or two more things my way. That's been the pattern over the years. I'm better at that than I was. Much, much better at that than I was. But that's still my tendency. Wait, I can fix it! Yeah, that's still my tendency. Even though I have many times surrendered to the fact that I can't fix it and that I'm not in control. Practical spirituality. If it's spiritual, it's gonna be practical. It's kind of like if God's behind it, what are you gonna do to mess it up? How bad can you mess with something that is spiritually correct? We get all worried about what effect something will have on our fellowship, right? If our fellowship is spiritually correct, we have nothing to worry about. I know my life boils down to many times either this Godship is working out or it isn't. And if it isn't, it don't matter. I can kiss it goodbye. I might as well assume that it is. Because without a God actively working in my life, without the reality of spirituality, I'm lost. I have no hope without the reality of spirituality. Spiritual principles don't work if there is no God, if there is nothing that I can look to for strength and guidance. courage and power and direction and knowledge that I'm lost. My experience is that when I look to some power greater than myself for those things, everything turns out fine. My disease doubts it and continues to doubt. A seventh truism, if you will, about service is that if the project's right, we don't have to worry about the money because it's going to be there. And how many times do we get caught up in all that stuff? If it's time for something, there are not going to be any obstacles that we can't overcome. Finances being a primary one. We get so caught up in, there's not enough money. We don't need a lot of money. We think we need a lot of money. We need a lot of money for some of the grandiosity we get caught in, too. I mean, activities. Probably a given activity could be one of the greatest drains on a community's resources, financial resources. It can also be one of the greatest contributors to a community's financial resource. But it doesn't cost nothing for me to ask people to go down and sit by the river at me on a Sunday afternoon when it's pretty. And that's just as valid an activity as a convention. But we forget that. You know, we need to get back to the basics of what's this all about. You know, can you celebrate your recovery by dancing in the sunshine? Yeah, you sure can. It doesn't have to be complicated, but we complicate it. And that's our disease. An eighth one, our service should be simple and straightforward. It doesn't have to be complicated. I strongly believe that God is the least complicated thing possible. If you had that much power, you wouldn't have to be complicated either. We're complicated. The reason we're complicated is because we're powerless. We're impotent. We got to be complicated and dazzle people with bullshit because we have no power. That's why we don't. I mean, that's why I'm complicated, because I'm powerless. Service doesn't have to be complicated. It should be simple and straightforward. Sometimes when I talk about, if you got to figure out God's will, you've missed the point. If you really got to study it and figure it all out, chances are you missed the point. It's kind of like, on a concrete example of that, one of the things I've spent probably cumulatively years doing was trying to figure out why I was all screwed up at various points in time. And what I've come to believe is that 9 times out of 10, when I'm nuts or all screwed up, there is a very simple explanation. Usually, it is either one of the halts or minor physical illness. And I don't have to look any further than that, probably more than 90% of the time. Either I'm out of whack with don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, tired, and take myself too seriously, or all those things those things represent. And I think that getting too hungry is talking about nutrition and taking care of yourself. Angry is talking about being strung out on various strong emotions. Lonely is talking about isolation and separation from others, as much as it is talking about feeling lonely. Tired is getting enough rest, getting enough taking care of yourself on another level, taking time to meditate. Taking yourself too seriously is representative of self-obsession and maybe other types of obsession too. And when I got a cold, I get obsessed with the cold. When I have a toothache, it becomes my world. And I end up crazy. Self-obsession. Very simple. Our services should be simple and straightforward. I noticed. All services should be open above board. There doesn't need to be any subterfuge in service. We don't have to do anything below the table. You know, I don't think it's ever necessary to go to an area service committee and hear the word surprise. To me, that's that dishonesty, that manipulation. It's not open and above board. Our traditions say we may create service boards and committees directly responsible to those they serve. Sometimes we need to ask ourselves who's serving who. And why the secrecy? Why do we have committees who are working on stuff that they're unwilling to share with us NA members? What are they afraid of, and who are they working for?
We want it to be a surprise.
I'm sorry. It offends me when I see our services acting underhandedly, dishonestly, and through manipulation and politics. It is offensive to me as a recovering addict, as a person who is trying to follow a spiritual path and be open and be honest. It is offensive to me when our services participate in contempt of conscience and do things through politics and manipulation. I don't believe that speaks well of a spiritual principle involved with service. The services we provide within our service structure should always be guided by principles. One of the things it says in the basic text under the second step is that true spiritual principles are never in conflict. So we should always guide our services by principle. That should be our number one guide. An 11th one, selfless services are ideal. And that, to me, is a recognition that, yes, we provide service without thinking what's in it for us. It's the act of giving as an act of devotion, perhaps, that is the highest type of service. But it's also recognition of the reality that a lot of times we get involved in service for other reasons. Service also happens to be one of the best ways for us to help improve our self-esteem. Because most of us come in here thinking that we can't succeed and be good at and helpful at anything. And we can achieve some success through participation in service. You know how good it feels when you talk to somebody on the helpline, or you talk to somebody in an H&I meeting, and then 3 months later they show up in a meeting? Yeah. Wow, you know what? Maybe I did make a difference with that person. The trap, of course, is thinking you're responsible for it. But I think it's okay to feel good about maybe you contributed. One of the neatest stories from my recovery about that is a few years ago I was in Wisconsin at a convention and someone came up to me and said, I know you, Greg. And we figured out that he had been, this was like 1987 or 88, I had carried a panel, H&I panel in the CRC, California Rehabilitation Center in Norco, California in 1971. And he remembered me from then. Now, I don't think I'm the reason he came back to Narcotics Anonymous 16, 17 years later. But I might be part of that. And that's the thing that each of us has the opportunity to be, is part of each other's recovery. You know, when you share something in a meeting and someone comes up to you afterwards and says, God, I never heard anybody say it quite like that. Thank you. That really helped me. Everybody here has probably experienced that. That's service. Wow. You know, I think this idea that selfless services are ideal. You know, We want to discount that stuff. But you know, it's okay to feel good about being a tool. As long as we remember that that we're not responsible for it. It's okay to feel good about being a good tool. About being true to what you believe in. About standing up and being counted. And finally, I think there's a basic truth about service that ultimately our service is in God's hands. And I think that's pretty self-explanatory. There's 12 things there that you're not going to see in the concepts of service that we pass at the World Service Conference. But I think those are just as much and perhaps more our basic philosophy about service in Narcotics Anonymous. I wasn't real pleased with the way our concepts turned out. I think that we missed an opportunity. With the 12 concepts as they exist today. I hope we can revisit them at some time in the future and maybe go back and look at what we believe in. What is our basic spiritual orientation towards service? What is our real relationship with this thing called we call service? And take another long, hard look at it and perhaps build some of these ideas into those concepts. There's another set that I alluded to. I did some writing on it a while back, and I won't get real far into it, but I believe we also have a challenge to talk about spirituality and our approach to spirituality. Self, society, service, and God. One, spirituality is a relationship with reality. In Narcotics Anonymous, we live just for today. We acknowledge and let go of our painful pasts and trust the future to the care of a loving God. In recovery, absolutes lose their meaning. We find that all things in life are a mixture of good and bad, positive and negative. We begin to look at the events and situations in our lives as opportunities or gifts from God. Each one is of value and provides a chance for us to learn and grow. We believe that each day we're given a reprieve from our active addiction. And it's only our attitudes and our actions that limit our recovery. And we talk about relationships a lot. Spirituality is a relationship with reality. Another basic truth that we accept as part of our spiritual path is that there is a spiritual power greater than any individual. It may be the power of the group for some. It may be an impersonal or a personal God of some sort, by some name. But I think as a fellowship, we espouse the idea that there is a power available to us that is greater than any individual. And that faith and belief in this power is the key to this way of life. Maybe faith, belief, trust. There's a continuum of faith that I've come to think of for myself. It talks about being a belief being the lowest form of faith because it's a mental process. I believe this is true. I think it's true. And that once our belief grows to a point, we're willing to risk some action based on those beliefs. And that's called trust. And as we continue to grow, we are able to take action without having to know the reason why, without having to get into the head trip that says, okay, it's going to be okay because we're able to do the right thing for the right reason, and that's called acceptance. Most of you have experienced that with using. When we first come around, we struggle with the idea of whether or not we're addicts. For most people who've been around any length of time, whether or not we're an addict is a non-issue. We no longer question. Oh yeah, if we get into a serious debate, we might get into, well, we have no absolute blah, 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 you know, get into that headset again. But for most of us, we don't live our lives focusing on, oh my God, I'm an addict. We live our lives. And there are certain things that we can and can't do because of our nature. One part of our nature is that we are addicts. But it's no longer an issue for most of us. When I wake up in the morning and have to go to the bathroom, It doesn't make any difference whether or not I'm an addict. It's not an issue. At that moment. Another basic tenet, if you will, is that Narcotics Anonymous is a spiritual program, not a religion. We believe strongly that there is not a clear set of rules that we must follow, that there is not an exclusive path to God. We believe very strongly in the right of each individual to their own understanding of this spiritual path. A fifth basic tenet is that Narcotics Anonymous is based on spiritual principles. Every meeting we read a statement that says, our program is a set of principles written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. Another part of our readings are that if there is one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery, this is an attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles. Those are two statements which underline this idea that we, as a group, believe that Narcotics Anonymous is based on spiritual principles and the application of spiritual principles. Six, true spiritual principles are never in conflict. That's in our basic text. The idea is that if something is spiritually correct, it's spiritually correct. You know, this power that we believe in is not going to have something that's spiritually correct and something over here that is spiritually correct and that they don't agree. How can that work? I mean, how can something that is true in all cases contradict something else that is true in all cases? It can't happen. A spiritual principle or something that is always true, that is always real, is not dependent upon causation or time or who is involved. It is a spiritual truth. How can something both be spiritually true and spiritually untrue at the same time? Can't happen. True spiritual principles are never in conflict. So when we find our actions in conflict, one of the first things we need to look at is the possibility that perhaps we've lost sight of the principle and that we're working on some other level. We believe as a group that what goes around comes around. You reap what you sow. Karma, if you will. The way you live determines the way you live. We believe in the principle of reciprocity as a group. I think that's part of our consciousness. But it makes a difference how you live. Yeah, you know, what you used to hear around the program, well, you can do anything you want as long as you stay clean. But most of us had our ass kicked enough behind that kind of an attitude to realize it ain't true. That you can't go out there and do whatever you damn please and expect to live a good life. That there is a relationship between the way we act and the way we live and what happens in our life. That if we're being dishonest, there's going to be a lot of dishonesty in our lives. If we're ripping and running, you know, we're going to pay the price. You know, if we're abusing people, we're going to be badly abused and have no friends. If we're rejecting everybody and unwilling to meet another person as a human being, then people will be unwilling to do that for us. We believe in that. What goes around comes around. Basic truth that we believe in. We also think that recovery is a spiritual journey. Well, there's a line that says that we grow spiritually. It's not like flipping a light switch. Here I am. Doesn't work that way. My own experience is that, you know, you ask the question, how does the program work? The best answer I've ever heard is very slowly. You know, this process is not a quick process. How long does it take to surrender? How do you answer that question? I guess surrender is instantaneous. How long does it get to the point? How long does it take to get to the point where we're willing to surrender? Yeah. usually longer than we can stand. Or until it hurts bad enough. You know, so it's, you know, we believe that this is a process. Our 12 steps are laid out in a way we practice the idea that you start with the first step and you build on it and you practice the principles involved in the second step. And as you get involved in some of that, even though most of us skip that, you know, initially, as you get involved with that process for a while, eventually you move and you begin practicing the principles involved in the third step as well. And these build upon each other. And as we reach a new milestone in our recovery and a new awareness, it changes our understanding of some of the stuff we've done before. And we have to build on that. I learned a lot about surrender through the sixth and seventh step. I learned a lot about first step through the sixth and seventh step the first time I went through. In fact, at that point, I learned so much about the first step that I was convinced that I needed to start all over again because my awareness changed entirely. And that's not an unusual experience. Other people have experienced the same thing. I think that we believe, or many of us believe, that ultimately recovery is based on divine intervention. Somehow, some way, we ended up stopped when we could not stop of our own, on our own power. Somehow, some way, our recovery was based on the intervention of a power greater than ourselves. Whether that's getting us locked up or thrown in treatment or whatever it is, I think as a fellowship pretty much agree on that. I think we believe as a fellowship that God works through people. That much of what we learn about spirituality, we get from our sponsors, we get from the literature, we get through people sharing from the podium, and the light bulb goes off. Someone says something and the light bulb goes off. Wow! Or maybe it's not even what they say, but the thoughts that what they say triggers in us. And I believe that that's God working through people. We believe that when the time is right, the people will appear in our lives that we need to talk to. I mean, we pretty much agree on that. That's our experience. We can, as part of that idea of God working through people. What I cannot do in my own power, we can do together. Maybe the easiest example of that would be that for me to stand at one end of this table and pick it up with one hand would be rather difficult. But if you stand at one end and I stand at the other end, the two of us could pick it up pretty easily. Any two of us. You know, that's a very obvious example of us working together. We can, or I can't. Recovery is a series of surrenders. I think that's a basic truth that most of us come to. That this is not just a one-shot deal, that you don't get well instantly, and that surrender is an ongoing process. One of the things that I have come to believe in very strongly is that there is no substitute for surrender. That although I've spent years trying to find things to avoid letting go of control and trusting God, that ultimately my actions are impotent, that I must surrender. And I make such a big deal out of it. But you know, we go through surrenders every day. When I wake up in the morning, one of the things I have to do at some point is surrender the comfort of that bed. And oftentimes that's what happens when my bladder fills up and it's no longer comfortable. Then it's a lot easier to surrender. That's kind of that surrender through pain, man, you know, mentality that most of us carry. But it doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't have to be that way. You can get up before you have to pee. You know, and sometimes it's nice. And, you know, you can go to the window and see the sunrise or something like that. Wow, and get spiritually charged. You know, it does not have to be the last possible instant. That analogy is real indicative for me about my recovery, because that's kind of about the way historically I've done things. I've held it as long as I could until it hurt real bad and finally let go. get up and do what I needed to do. You know, so that's why I say that. And it's because it's cute, too. We all experience that. But I believe that recovery is a series of surrenders. When I thought I've got it licked, it hasn't been very long that another surrender has reared its ugly head. And I realized that I was just beginning. And that's still true, just as true today as it ever was. Now, finally, and I think this relates directly back to the symbol, is that the promise of recovery is freedom. We can be free in spite of ourselves, in spite of our failures. The tragedies of our past do not predestine our future. That through participation in this spiritual way of life, we can be free. We can be spirit. And that's a wonderful promise. I didn't understand it. And knew coming in, that's not what I was interested in. I was interested in not hurting anymore. But you know, the glimpses of freedom that I've had are very special. And I get to see those glimpses of freedom in other members' eyes, in sunrise. I get to experience them in a hug or a quiet touch. When I don't have to be bound by my prejudice, by my insanity, by my disease. And ultimately, that's what NA offers. Freedom. Thank you.
Thanks, Gray. Enjoyed it. I think that's about all of us. We have a wonderful way of closing. Let's circle up and close.